Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, born before arrival babies. What is it about babies who are born before the mum can get to the labour ward? And how well do they fare? The best treatment for bipolar disorder, the oldest and cheapest might be the one. How type 2 diabetes might actually be five different conditions, each of which needs its own treatment. And bowel cancer, one of the commonest internal malignancies and causes of cancer death. It's preventable through the detection of polyps in the bowel before they turn cancerous. There's been evidence that people on a diet that's naturally high in vitamin D and calcium protects against bowel cancer. But a recently published trial of vitamin D and calcium supplements has made a worrying discovery in relation to a type of precancerous polyp called a serrated polyp. Seth Crockett was the lead author. He's at the University of North Carolina, and I spoke to him earlier.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
How important are these serrated polyps in general?
These are a really interesting type of colon polyp. Serrated polyps are sort of like the less common cousin of the more typical precancerous polyp that we pick up on colonoscopy, known as adenomatous polyps. They are really difficult to find on colonoscopy and other screening tests, and they differ from adenomatous polyps in terms of the steps they take to develop into a cancer.
Is a serrated polyp more likely to turn into cancer faster than an adenomatous polyp?
It's an active area of research. At this point, we think that their risk of cancer is about the same as an adenomatous polyp, but there are certain types of serrated polyps that we think have the potential for more rapid growth and transformation into colon cancer.
I don't know if we know the answer to this question, but if you take all colorectal cancer, all cancer in the large bowel, what proportion would come from adenomatous polyps versus serrated polyps?
So we think about 20 to 30% of colorectal cancer. This is sporadic colorectal cancer, so occurring in patients who don't have a familial syndrome or a genetic predisposition. So about 30% of those cancers are due to a serrated polyp precursor.
Now, you started this randomized trial in the belief that calcium and vitamin D would actually reduce the incidence of polyps.
We did. The study was undertaken, and it was a pretty large effort, 11 centers across the U.S., over 2,000 participants who had had a colonoscopy and a polyp detected at baseline. And they were randomized to receive calcium, vitamin D, the combination of those two, or placebo.
And this was really a chemo prevention trial where you were seeing whether you could prevent the incidence of further polyps.
Exactly, yes. As you pointed out, the study was undertaken because a number of studies have shown that patients with diets rich in calcium and vitamin D appear to be at lower risk of developing polyps and even colorectal cancer. So the idea was maybe if we give them more, that would have a preventive effect or protective effect against colorectal cancer.
So you did this randomization. You followed them up for several years. What did you find?
Looking at that more common polyp type, adenomatous polyps, there essentially was no benefit at all of either calcium, vitamin D, or the combination. So that was somewhat surprising. We undertook the subsequent study to look at this other type of polyp. Contrary to our expectations, the more than doubling of risk for serrated polyps 6 to 10 years after the initiation of the study.
And did you find any cancers?
Our report does not look at cancer as an outcome. We use the precursor lesions or the precancerous polyps as sort of a surrogate for cancer. And it helps us understand things that may protect against polyps, we think would also protect against cancer and vice versa.
So why should, if a diet rich in calcium and vitamin D seems to be protective, and that's often, that's a kind of a diet that's rich in vegetables, that's a surrogate. There's been plenty of studies suggesting that a vegetable-rich diet that's low in red meat is protective against colorectal cancer. Why should supplements increase the risk?
That's a really interesting question. I don't think that we know, but there have been a number of studies that have shown this discrepancy, whereas epidemiologic studies that look at patients' diet and micronutrient components of their diet and their risk of various health outcomes appear to show a benefit in patients with diets high in calcium and folate and some of these other micronutrients. But when you try and give them those micronutrients in the form of a supplement, we sometimes see harm.
Calcium supplements are on the nose, really, because they have been suggested to increase the risk of coronary heart disease, particularly heart attack. Did you see an increased risk with vitamin D and calcium, or was it the same increased risk suggesting it was just the calcium that did the job rather than the vitamin D?
We saw the risk that appeared to be associated with calcium, and we looked at vitamin D alone, so patients who got vitamin D versus placebo, there was not a statistically significant elevated risk. However, in patients who received the combination of calcium and vitamin D, their risk of sessile serrated polyps, one class of these serrated polyps, was nearly quadrupled.
So you did get a multiplier effect with vitamin D, a suggestion there. Now, did any other risk factors for colon cancer make this worse, such as family history or smoking or alcohol use?
We did look at many subgroups to try and better understand these findings because, you know, as I mentioned, this was somewhat unexpected. And we did find that smokers, in particular current smokers across the board, appear to have higher risk of serrated polyps if they were exposed to calcium.
In Australia, we have a national bowel cancer screening program. Only about 1 in 3 people actually participate in it, unfortunately, over the age of 50. But nonetheless, unless you have a strong family history of bowel cancer in your family, it's very hard to predict who's going to get bowel cancer, who's going to get polyps or not, particularly if you're not engaging in the bowel cancer screening program. You can't really tell us whether or not this applies to the general population or just the population who've already had one polyp diagnosed.
Yes, that's an important limitation. However, we do think that the results from these chemo-preventive studies are applicable to patients who don't have those lesions because the biology should be the same. In the U.S., the body that reviews the preventive measures that we take on a population level, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, has given an I recommendation, I for insufficient evidence for calcium supplements for postmenopausal women to prevent fractures. So, you know, certainly in that population, I think the risk-benefit ratio is a little shaky.
Seth, thanks very much for joining us on the Health Report.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed talking with you.
Seth Crockett is in the Division of Gastroenterology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. You're listening to the Health Report here on RN, ABC News and CBC Radio across Canada. I'm Norman Swan. Stay till the end of the program. We've got a really important announcement from you because we need your help. But now for bipolar disorder. It's a serious, highly disabling form of depression, and there have been questions about which is the best drug to treat the condition. This hasn't been helped by pharmaceutical marketing, which may have muddied the water. A study of 18,000 people with bipolar disorder, followed for over 7 years, has assessed which are the most effective medications. It's an important question for people living with bipolar and their carers. For comment, here's Professor Michael Burke of Deakin University, a world authority on the condition.
The essence of bipolar disorder is that it's a disorder where one has phases of depressed mood and phases with elevated or expansive or inflated mood. The difference between bipolar 1 and bipolar 2 really goes to how high or manic one goes. So in bipolar 1, one has substantial episodes of mood elevation or mania, whereas in bipolar 2, one has relatively milder episodes of mania or mood elevation. Depression is universal across both phases.
And it's a deep, very dark depression.
It's a deep, very dark depression, and it's arguably the most lethal of all psychiatric disorders in terms of risk for suicide.
And before we get on to the treatment here, there's a notorious delay in diagnosis. It comes on usually in adolescence, but takes a while for people to realise what's going on.
That is correct. So the average age of onset is around about 17, and there's often a long delay to diagnosis. Now, some of this is avoidable through better recognition, but some of it is not avoidable because it tends to begin with things like depression or sometimes even panic attacks, complicated by substance abuse and many other things. And often it's only after the passage of time that the presence of manic episodes becomes clear, at which time you can make a diagnosis.
So it's clouded by adolescent behavior and other psychological issues.
Absolutely, and it's also clouded by the fact that most people have depression before mania. So they initially look like they're suffering from depression, but it's only after they've had an episode of mania that it becomes clear that the disorder is not depression, it's actually bipolar disorder.
Now, this study looked at which treatments seem to be most effective when you look at the drugs. Their outcome was actually preventing people going into hospital with bipolar disorder. Is that a valid measure?
I think it is a useful measure. It's not the only measure, but for these kind of nationwide studies, it's a pretty good proxy of illness. So it certainly would be a measure of more severe episodes of illness, but it absolutely wouldn't reflect milder episodes of illness which wouldn't get one into hospital.
Now, there's this drug called lithium, which is an Australian discovery. John Cade in the 50s, I think it was, or 40s or 50s.
Correct.
Which revolutionised the treatment of bipolar disorder. And then drug companies have got in trying to flog a lot of their other drugs that they're using for other things like epilepsy and various other conditions and claiming that it's good, they're good for bipolar disorder. And this study was really trying to sort of clear away what the actual facts are.
Absolutely. And the good news is that lithium probably still remains the best treatment that we have for bipolar disorder. The bad news is that it's still the best treatment we have for bipolar disorder.
Why is that bad news?
Because it's not perfect for everybody, and it's not a medication without risks. We definitely and quite urgently need newer and better treatments for psychiatric disorders, but lithium still remains the benchmark treatment.
And how effective were those other drugs? There were antipsychotic drugs, drugs not normally used in schizophrenia, and also these so-called atypical antiepileptics used for epilepsy.
Correct. And it's clear that antipsychotics are useful for a number of people with bipolar disorder, particularly so for mania, but a number of these medications do help for depression as well. In terms of the anticonvulsants, they clearly are effective. Valproate is useful as a mood stabilizer, and lamotrigine, which is another antiepileptic drug, is particularly useful for depression and I think particularly useful for bipolar 2 disorder.
So how does a consumer, adolescent with a parent or a psychiatrist decide what's right for a person?
One always is influenced by these aggregate data, which suggests, as this study does, that lithium is the best way to go. But a good clinician would always look at a variety of other clinical factors, and many of the symptoms or patterns of illness that a person would present would suggest to an astute clinician that one or another of these agents may be preferable for an individual. I believe that it's essential for any consumer to have an informed view of the treatments available and have a role in choosing, because many of these choices are in equipoise and one could rationally choose one or another different treatment at any stage of the illness.
Now, it's been suggested for a while that one of the important reasons for diagnosing bipolar disorder early is that if you treat somebody with depression with traditional antidepressants and they've really got bipolar disorder, you can make them a lot worse.
That is correct. And that is one of the real risks. And indeed, that's one of the things that this study found, that if you looked at the treatments that helped, exactly as you mentioned, lithium, the antipsychotics, and the anticonvulsants all seemed to help, but the antidepressants didn't as a group. In fact, as a group, if you look at this study, people who got antidepressants might have done slightly worse. Now, is this truly an effective antidepressant? That's certainly possible. But it's also possible that people who are more depressed are more likely to be prescribed antidepressants. And so the prescription of antidepressants might be a marker of a more severe pattern of illness. But one of the striking things in the study was that antidepressants did not seem to confer much benefit. And the same was actually true for the benzodiazepine tranquilizers, medicines of the Valium class. People who took those medications clearly seemed to do worse than people who were not taking them.
So the bottom line here then is what, Michael?
The bottom line here is that lithium is probably still our first choice agent, that in general agents that we would broadly class as mood stabilizer, and that includes lithium, anticonvulsants and some antipsychotics, probably should be first-line agents for this disorder, and one should be using antidepressants cautiously and sparingly.
And finally, Michael Berg, you're an internationally renowned researcher in bipolar disorder. Anything new coming out of the lab?
There are a number of really interesting new things coming out. There's a lot of interest in anti-inflammatory therapies, because bipolar disorder, like many other psychiatric disorders, is characterized by elevated levels of inflammation. Our group is working on a number of novel therapies for bipolar disorder, both psychological, internet-based therapies, and pharmacotherapies.
So psychotherapy can help in bipolar disorder?
Unquestionably, psychotherapy is a critical part of living with bipolar disorder. It certainly helps, in addition to mood stabilizers, to deal with depression, it helps with relapse prevention, and it helps improve quality of life in people who have this disorder.
Which form of psychotherapy?
People have looked at cognitive behavior therapy, they've looked at family-based therapies, they've been looking at integrative models, which include psychoeducation. Probably the best evidence is for psychoeducation, which is really a package of skills, tools, and techniques to help people understand the illness and learn how best to manage the illness.
Michael Berg, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Norman.
Michael Berk is Professor of Psychiatry at Deakin University in Victoria. You've heard the story many times. It always sounds dramatic. A very pregnant woman goes into labour. Her harassed partner is driving her to hospital, but the baby is born before arrival. Is this just an accident of fate, or is there something about such pregnancies? And how do the babies do? That's been the focus of a recent study, and the ABC's health reporter Olivia Willis has the story. But another of our science reporters actually had a baby before arrival. Welcome to Tegan Taylor, one of our digital producers in science in our Brisbane studios. Welcome,
Hello.
Tegan.
Hello.
Hi. So this was your second child, Tegan. Tell us the story.
Correct. So my first baby took her sweet time coming out, so I wasn't in a rush to get to the hospital the second time. Turns out that everyone tells you that your second baby's going to be a lot quicker and that you should get to the hospital early, but I didn't believe them. And I proved
So you sat home, you made yourself a cup of coffee, put your feet up.
That's it. I really thought I'd get a lot more warning than I did. And in the end, she was born on the bathroom floor at my parents-in-law's house.
How did that happen?
Well, we were at home. I was sort of realised the baby was going to come. We jumped in the car and they lived sort of en route to the hospital. And my husband sort of heard the noises I was making in the back seat and thought, that sounds like a baby's about to come out. So he pulled over at their place and went inside and called an ambulance. But and I got down on the bathroom floor and pushed a baby out.
And what's her name?
Hadley.
Hadley. And how did Hadley do?
She was fine. She was 9 days overdue. I really should have been at hospital. It wasn't like she was early or anything like that.
How old's Hadley now?
She's 4.
Right.
And she's great.
That's good. So if you have a third, you know what to do.
If, yes. Yeah.
Way off. Olivia Willis, you've been looking at this research. Tell us about the study.
Yeah, so basically some researchers at Western Sydney University wanted to try and better understand why some women do give birth before they make it to the hospital and if there's any, I guess, risk factors involved or any kind of commonalities with these women.
So how typical is Tegan's story?
Tegan's kind of like our perfect case study because she's very typical. It happens most commonly with women who are having their second baby.
For the reasons that Tegan said, you had a difficult delivery first
exactly.
time.
Exactly. It's either a long or quite a difficult delivery the first time, and so they go into the second one quite relaxed, and when contractions start, they're a little bit more slow-paced to kind of get going, and often it happens, the labour happens a lot quicker than the first.
And it's more common in baby girls than baby boys.
That's right, yeah. It tends to happen a little bit more with baby girls, and they think that's because the researchers told me generally that baby girls tend to get into a bit of a better position and a kind of, I guess...
They're more organised than boys.
A little bit, yeah, it makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. Any other risk factors? I mean, so it's not just full-term babies because Tegan was post-term.
Yes.
Premature babies are often...
That's right. They're more likely, these babies are more likely to be premature and they're more likely to be a smaller birth weight. And in terms of the mothers, like distance from hospitals is obviously a risk factor. So it happened more commonly in women who live in regional and rural areas who couldn't get to the hospital in time. And they also found a correlation with women who live in areas where there's high rates of home birth. And they think...
Oh, really?
Yeah. So they think what might be going on there is actually that these women, or a proportion of these women didn't actually ever plan to go to the hospital. They planned to have a free birth without a medical person there to assist.
Right.
And then potentially complications spring up after the birth and they call the ambulance.
And then it was delivered in the thing. So it was kind of a half home birth.
Kind of, yeah.
And how did the babies do?
The babies that are born before arrival do have kind of more adverse outcomes than their counterparts who are born in hospitals. But it's so that, you know, they're more likely to go to kind of neonatal intensive care or a special care nursery unit. But the thing to note there is that those kind of outcomes are associated more commonly with prematurity than with the baby being born before arrival. So it's not because they didn't make it to hospital often that there's an adverse outcome. It's because they're quite premature.
And what about the mother? Was there a higher instance of tears or obstetric complications?
Yeah, there were some instances of that. But similar to Tegan's case, if the baby's been carried full term and it's been a pretty healthy pregnancy, then the risks are generally not too bad.
And it's kind of pre-tested, so you know what's going. And did the researchers have any advice for this, apart from phoning early?
that was one of them. Look, they said not to worry. Women shouldn't worry about it too much. Often women do, and it's a pretty rare occurrence. It's about every 4 in 1,000 births that this happens. They said if it does happen, the best thing to do is to keep the baby nice and warm, to bring it straight up onto your chest, and not to cut any cords. Don't cut the placenta cord. Don't kind of get into the messy business of it. Just wrap the baby up, keep it warm, and call an ambulance.
Right. Because some people say you should actually keep the baby below the level of the cord so that the baby gets a bit more blood.
Well, that may be too for technical.
Another time, yes, for another time. So, Tegan, I mean, in retrospect, I mean, have any of your friends had an out-of-born before arrival, or are you the only one?
Oh, you hear, as you said in your intro, you hear all the stories, but no one who I know very well did. A couple of close calls, a couple of hospital car parks, at least one of those. And my sister's about to have her second, and she's been duly warned by me not to dally.
And did you follow the advice that Olivia just gave about keeping the baby warm and up on your chest?
The ambos arrived about 2 minutes before my daughter did. So by the time she actually came out, we did have assistance. And they were great. Obviously, they knew exactly what to do, and they bundled us into the ambulance and off to hospital.
There's nothing a paramedic likes more than a delivery. Happy ending to a nice story.
Exactly.
Thank you very much to you both, to Olivia Willis, who is the ABC's online health reporter, and Tegan Taylor, who's also in our science unit as a digital producer and reporter. Thank you very much to you both. And Olivia has an article on this on the ABC's health and wellbeing website. Not to be missed, lots of great stuff on that website. Type 2 diabetes, that's the form of diabetes which comes on in adulthood, and it's growing into a global epidemic. It can cause blindness, heart disease, strokes and kidney failure, to mention but a few. The treatment is pretty standard. It tends to be focused on diet, exercise, weight loss, controlling your blood sugar and risk factors like cholesterol and blood pressure. But despite all that, diabetes often marches on and causes havoc. The question is why? Well, an astounding study from Sweden has suggested a reason. Analysing data from thousands of people followed from their new diagnosis with type 2 diabetes for some years, they found five different patterns with their own risks of complications and need for treatment. On the line from Lund is one of the researchers, Leif Groop. Welcome to the Health Report.
Thank you. Good morning.
How did you classify, so you got these people with diabetes, how did you classify them? You did, well, I think, six different tests on them.
Yeah, I mean, we have been, during 100 years, diagnosed diabetes by measuring only one thing, blood sugar. We thought that we will add a few more things. So we added measurements of insulin secretion, how sensitive they are to insulin, also took into account, body weight, or what we call body mass index, and long-term glycemic control. And then we fed these six variables into the computer and asked, how many forms of diabetes do we have? And we got the answer, five, and then we replicated in three independent populations. So we were pretty sure that the answer was correct.
So five different types of diabetes. And just before we go on, I need to explain a couple of things. So when you're looking at insulin, one of the things that typifies type 2 diabetes is that you can produce a lot of insulin, so that's the insulin level, but the body can be resistant to the effects of insulin, which is why the blood sugar goes up, and that's one of the things that you're talking about there. And this long-term control was another of these variables. So just briefly, what were the five different types?
I mean, let's say type 1, or the what we call cluster 1, that overlaps with type 1 diabetes. So they clearly have this, what we call an autoimmune destruction of the insulin-producing cells. But now they were adults. I mean, type 1 usually occurs in children. And then cluster 2 was quite large, 20%. It was insulin deficient as the type 1s, but they, since they had been diagnosed as type 2, they received the treatment for type 2, metformin, and had very poor metabolic control, and had a high risk of developing diabetic eye disease, so they clearly need intensified treatment in the future. Cluster 3 was about 15%. As you mentioned and talked about insulin resistance, they were really the insulin resistant group. They had surprisingly good glucose or blood sugar, but they had 4 to 5-fold increased risk of developing diabetic kidney disease.
Kidney failure.
Then we had cluster 4, which is related to obesity and cluster 5 to age, they both accounted for about half of the patients. They're very mild forms of diabetes. They don't really need more than some lifestyle advice, probably metformin, and they don't really need to see a doctor as often as currently recommended.
So and these were elderly?
I think in the future we should focus on the three severe forms.
Right. These were the elderly people who were the last ones with the morbidine. And when you say metformin, metformin is one of the older drugs for the use in type 2 diabetes, which is pretty effective, helps you lose weight and keeps blood pressure under control, may even prevent cancer as well. So how...
Yeah, if it's effective, I don't know. It's a very mild drug, but it works and it's quite cheap.
So the three you're saying that you identify the three who are at high risk, the younger people with who are relatively who have relatively poor control, people who are insulin resistant but high risk of kidney disease, and the other group which was high risk of other diabetic complications such as the eyes. I mean, do we know what to do about these now that you've identified these five different groups? Do you actually know what to do, or there's a whole research agenda about that? In other words, should GPs in Australia start doing these five tests on everybody with diabetes? Six tests.
I mean, what actually they need to do is to measure something. It's a product of insulin called C-peptide, because that we use then to estimate insulin secretion and insulin sensitivity. And they have to measure an autoantibody to those insulin-producing cells. But I can see that it's early for GPs. So what we're trying to do is to develop what we call a clinical decision support system, which is actually a GPS or a computer program. So if they measure these from the newly diagnosed patients, then this computer program would tell which group, what treatment, what are the risks with treatment and things like that. So we hope that we would have that available in a year. So we'll start to test it probably still during this year, but hopefully it will be available, even in Australia.
Even in Australia, some things do get to us sometime. We never know. And presumably in this older group of people, which is quite a large group with type 2 diabetes, it would actually save on treatment. You don't need to do that much.
No, I mean, in the long run, we think that this new classification even might save money for the society, because and also for the patients. I think it's good to know that, okay, I have a mild disease, but I don't have to worry too much.
Leif Groop, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Leif Groop is principal investigator in the Diabetes and Endocrinology Group at Lund University in Sweden. You've been listening to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Now, I've got an important announcement for you, and it's about out-of-pocket or gap costs, because they're a huge issue in the private sector. They make people wonder why they bother with private health insurance when they have to spend hundreds or sometimes thousands of dollars beyond what they get back. Some would say it's threatening the future of private health insurance. Four Corners and the Health Report are investigating out-of-pocket expenses and their impact on our health system and indeed you. If you have a bill for cancer treatment, urology, orthopaedics or eye surgery, or indeed any other specialty that got you confused, angry or upset, we'd love you to send us the bill. Just go to our website and click on the link to fill out a simple form. We won't pass on your identity to anyone else, but we may contact you for more information. It'd be great if you could help us out. That's the Health Report for this week. Look forward to seeing you next time.